What's up, everybody? Before we start the show, I just want to put out a reminder and a thank you. First and foremost, thank you guys so much for supporting everything we've been doing over the last 7 years or so. If you want to help support the show, easiest way to do that is head over to whatsinyourhead.com. Click on any of the links on our website. If you're on a computer, those links will be on the right. If you're on a tablet or a cell phone, scroll to the bottom. You'll find the links on the bottom. I especially suggest heading over if you're a fisherman, an angler, if you're wanting to get into fishing, you hear me, Mike, and Morgan talking about it, and you're trying to find affordable quality equipment, head over to whatsinyourhead.com or d-410.com. Click on the Cast King link and check them out. You can get quality, and I mean quality. If you guys have seen my YouTube channels, especially within the last 2 years, just about all of my fishing equipment is Cast King, and that's because it is quality and, more importantly, affordable. So if you want to help support the show plus get some quality fishing equipment, head over to d-410.com or whatsinyourhead.com. Click on the Cast King logo, and anything you purchase helps go to support what we're doing. Thank you guys so much. Before we start this podcast, I want to do the big giveaway for the month of April, even though we're now into May, but this is for the advanced copy of our friend Mir's book, The Houdini Club, The Epic Journey and Daring Escapes of the First Army Rangers. So I have all of our names in a bin here. We're going to give it a shaky, shake, 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 shake. I'm going to pull out a name here. And the winner is Mr. Connor Trent. Congratulations, sir. Connor Trent, you are the winner of the April giveaway of the Houdini Club. I will reach out to you on Patreon. Please log in and check your messages. I'll get your address and we'll get this book and some stickers sent out your way. Congratulations. And a reminder, if you guys wanted the opportunity to win on the next Patreon giveaway, please head over to whatsthescuttlebutt.com, whatsinyourhead.com, or d-410.com. Click on the Patreon link, sign up, and subscribe. All you have to do is be an active subscriber to be eligible for the next giveaway. Thank you guys so much. On with the show.
Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's in Your Head podcast.
Digitized live from
your company name here.
Your studios in Cape Coral, Florida. It's the What's in Your Head podcast.
What's up? What's up, OG5? We're back with another episode of the What's in Your Head podcast. We went a little bit long there because I was waiting for Mike to say, yo, dude, I'm ready. But you know what? I gave up on that. We let Ren carry us into the beginning of the show, and we're back. Half of Morgan is back. I'm concerned. You are whittling away with longing, I think. Either longing or...
I'm sorry. I didn't realize that you were waiting on me.
I said, are you all ready? Meanwhile, Moby joined the show. What's up, Moby? You got any new records coming out? How much weight are you down?
Odell, I was down about 40, but I've been able to eat again.
You got him so, popping Mississippi tapeworm.
Well, yeah, I don't know what was going on. Well, part of it was I had shingles, and that makes it, you know, extremely difficult to eat and do anything else. All you want to do is just crawl in a hole and die, and yeah, pretty rough stuff.
First things first, congratulations on making it to the age where one gets shingles. The last person I know to have shingles was my grandfather. He had it 3 times. So that's an accomplishment in and of itself. For those of y'all playing along at home, shingles is actually comes from the chicken pox virus, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. It's an advanced form. Yeah, this was this was my fifth round. Yeah.
Good Lord.
So, yay me.
Mike, your kid is probably the youngest kid out of all of our kids. Has your kid have chicken pox?
No.
Do kids still get chicken pox?
I don't think so.
Is it wiped out with the jab?
Well, I don't know that it's wiped out per se, but it's definitely... Well, actually, there was one. What was it? It was recent. Measles. Did you guys hear about the measles outbreak coming back?
That's a goose of a different color.
I mean, I'm pretty sure we all got a measles vaccine or something like that at one point, right?
Oh yeah, you get measles, mumps, and rubella all one shot.
So I mean, you know, we've been getting that vaccine for how long now? I mean, at least 30 years, probably 40 or 50 or more even.
What vaccine is that?
The measles.
We're talking chickenpox.
I know, but my addition to that is the vaccine has been around for quite a while for measles, and that still popped back up. So, I mean, whether or not chickenpox is completely, you know, out of the game, I don't want to say that.
I haven't had health insurance since like 2003. So
holy
I'm not
shit.
Paid on my inoculations. Fun fact, Morgan, did you know that there was a chickenpox vaccine that was produced in 1995?
Yes.
I didn't, because 1995 was my sophomore year. I had more things to worry about than chickenpox. But the answer, according to AI, since the introduction of the chickenpox vaccine in the United States in 1995, chickenpox cases have declined by over, anybody got a guess percentage?
63%.
Mike?
73%.
As you plan at home, probably think Mike's way over. Mike is under.
Holy shit.
97. Oh, wow. Declined by 97%, which would make sense.
Wow.
None of us can remember the last time anybody got chickenpox.
Right.
I was born in 78, which chickenpox is like a little kid thing primarily. You know, you usually get in elementary school.
Sure.
And Morgan can remember this. So I was born 98, 99, 78, 79, 80, 81, 82, 80. So around 83, 84, I was 5 years old, just getting into kindergarten, first grade, you know, 86. I tell you exactly where I was when I got chickenpox. We're at my cousin Johnny and Matt's trailer up on top of the holler. And fun fact, if you guys go to Analog 410 and go to the guns video, you'll see a video of me, my cousin Johnny, and my very young Sariana shooting an AR-15 in Kentucky. You can't tell, but behind us is a single wide trailer completely engulfed in weeds because they moved out of there in 2001. We're shooting down what used to be their driveway and up to the right. And in the video, you will see, and I'll link it on this episode, we walk around the barn that has collapsed. And he's showing how the hayloft fell and is being propped up by the old headboard of his waterbed. Rewind to 1984-ish, 1983. I was standing below said hayloft when his older brother, Matt, pissed on me. Golden rain from the sky, because, you know, that's what Kentucky boys do. You just piss on one another. And so I remember lifting up my shirt to see I had chickenpox.
Oh, no.
So, of course, where does a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old who got pissed on think chickenpox come from? Clearly being peed on. So I remember my mom and my aunt were laying out in the sun on those old, remember the old clickety 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 trifold?
Oh, yeah, the old chaise lounges.
That were made out of like the, it was like blue,
the
white,
PVC
blue.
Wrapping.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, kind of like what your kids would have, like their friendship bracelets made out of today. And so, of course, back then they're all covered in iodine and in oil and Crisco. And so you had to put a towel down that thing, or you slide out of it like a slip and slide. Or if you're broke, half of the plastic's broken, and so your ass is sinking down, and so you got to put the blanket on it. But anyhow, they're laying in those clickety clack ratcheted system PVC lounge chairs getting sun, and I shared my mom, and that's how I got chickenpox. Morgan, how did you acquire chickenpox?
I don't know. I was probably 6 or 7, and my mom had an in-house daycare, and we all had it, and all of a sudden, it was great because we had a party for like 3 or 4 days because all the kids just stayed overnight and overnight and overnight because they all had chicken pox. And then all of
that
these
was
other
thing.
Kids showed up.
Yep, and that's what I was kind of getting to. That was the thing. This is probably long dead and gone by the time you were a teenager, Mike. Back in the 70s and 80s, especially like if one of the neighborhood kids got chickenpox in the summertime before school started, it was a phone, phone calls. Bring everybody over to Sheila's house. Let's get the chickenpox out of the way before school starts. It wasn't keep away from Johnny. He's got no, it's bring your kids over. Let's get the shit out of the way. Because the idea is you get it once, you build an immune system to it, you never break out again until you're 63, and then you get shingles 5 times. But anyhow, yes.
Yeah, so hey, everybody back up at that 63 business, buddy.
59 and a half.
I got a little ways to go before I get there.
But how is talk about end of a spectrum? You know, you want to talk about why Gen X is so fucking rugged. Your parents made you put on a mask for COVID. Our parents are gathering us up in the fucking Winnebago, stacking us on top of each other like cordwood, so we get the chicken pox from the neighborhood kid to get it out of the way so we didn't miss any school. That was the thing.
Did you ever see the episode of South Park where Kenny had chicken pox and they were all trying to get parents were trying to get her together?
I don't remember that one.
Speaking of inoculations, I gave you guys the homework assignment, which I know you didn't do it. John Adams. The old HBO series John Adams was a great series. But in that series, they're showing how wasn't measles, but back in like the plague or whatever the fuck it was. They were getting the big old sores on them back in like the 1700s, 1800s. But anyhow,
fuck, what was that?
Oh, hold on, I'll Google it.
No,
the bubonic chronic.
Yeah,
I forget what it was. Smallpox. So they're showing how they got smallpox inoculations back in. We want to complain about shots now. John Adams, the series, will show you how there's nothing funny about the practice of tar and feathering somebody. We all think it's funny, particularly Gen Xers, because we had old Looney Tune cartoons from the 30s and 40s that would show people getting tarred and feathered. Ha, 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 ha. No, they showed it in full frontal nudity when they tarred the tax man, where they tore off his skin. And the tar was not just tar. It was tar that was boiling hot. They would dump it on your skin so it would burn your skin, fill your pores, and you'd basically sweat to death and die of pain. And then the feathers was just for humiliation. And so they showed it full frontal. Like, you're like, you watch this and your stomach's turned. They literally put him on a rail, like a railroad tie, tied to it, and carry his ass out of town. So they literally rode his ass out of town on a railroad tie. But they show in that movie Abigail Adams having her kids inoculated from smallpox. You know the scene in Bring Out Your Dead. Monty Python, Search for Holy
Grail.
It's more serious. There's no one screaming, bring out your dead. But the doctor comes to John Adams' home with that same wagon full of bodies that are alive, that are all almost dead with smallpox. He would go out there, puncture a smallpox wound, gather up the pus, go into the house with a 1763 version of a scalpel, if you can picture what that is, basically a sharp piece of aluminum, cut the kids open, and then take the swab of pus that just came off of George out in the wagon on the front stoop, is probably also covered in horse shit, and then gouge it into their freshly opened wound. That was how inoculations originally started. And then obviously all the kids got smallpox, but a smaller version of it, and their immune system built up. But you watch that, and you're like, yeah, I guess maybe that shot in the ass isn't so bad for that I had to get my TB booster in third grade.
Could you imagine, Mike, going through the shot gauntlet in the Army if they had to cut you open and jab you full of a spoonful of pus?
How many wagons would there have been out front, right?
Oh, my gosh.
That was already bad enough without having to fucking deal with that. Add that in the mix. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, I'm going AWOL. I'm not dealing with it.
And a helmet for my pillow. Robert Lucky's talking about how there's a guy in boot camp. He's just this barrel-chested, corn-fed farm boy. He's so wide. He wasn't fat. He was just a brick shithouse. He was so wide, he took up two positions in the line, and the corpsmen were doing that jab thing so quickly that both of them jabbed him twice in both arms. And so instead of getting it once, he got four times. They had to take him to the hospital because he literally just got the same inoculation four times in two different arms.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I pulled up that scene in John Adams. That is fucking brutal.
Which one, the tar and feathering or the inoculation scene?
No, the tarn, and you're right, full frontal. I mean, you can see
Oh, and you know, and
his members hanging out there, like, hey, what's up, buddy?
That's an actor who really wanted the gig.
Yeah, exactly.
You know who's standing next to John Adams in that scene, that fun loving scene?
Who's that?
Good old Sam. Sam Adams, the beer guy, Adams' cousin. He kind of incited that riot that resulted in that poor son of a bitch getting tarred and feathered. So
right.
Remember that next time you're drinking your pumpkin ale. That's Sam Adams. He was a fun loving fella.
Good Lord. Yeah, that's fucking rough. Like, and when you think about stuff like that from back in the day, like when, you know, like torturous type of, you know, humiliation and stuff like
Falling
that.
Cold
It's
spring.
like medieval type shit. I mean, even not that long ago when you're talking with, you know, when John Adams was around, that kind of shit. I mean,
remember how we all felt the first time
fuck.
We saw Braveheart at the end when they
yeah.
cut his stomach open and pulled his innards out.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Nothing like getting drawn and
fucking,
quartered.
No.
Fucking nuts. Like, and, well, and you know, some of those, what was it? The one that would stretch you.
Mm-hmm.
Where you'd take all your
the
limbs,
rack.
The rack, yeah. And there was variations of it too, because I know there was a few where it would pull you straight, and then there were other ones where it would pull you out like that.
I don't think the Spaniards get enough shit for the Spanish Inquisition. Those came up with some. You thought the torture scene from Wu-Tang Clan's 36 Chambers, torture, motherfucker, torture. I'll take your dick and I'll put it on the back of the spike bat. No. The Spaniards, they had the amount of crap they came up with was insane.
Brutal. Brutal and scary. Scary. I mean, that's where, you know, that's where the human mind can actually go.
It's like,
oh my gosh,
that is fucking
your choice.
That's scarier.
Anything you've seen in the movie Saul or anything from the book of the Spanish Inquisition, give me Saul any goddamn day.
Yeah, I'll cut off a foot. I'm good with that.
No one expects the Spanish Inquisition. And
yeah,
on
that
note,
that shit from back then was just absolutely nutty.
The What's Your Head podcast would like to send a farewell and a rest in peace to Val Kilmer. We know from Top Gun, The Doors, of course, Doc Holliday and
Tombstone.
I don't know if I'm embarrassed by this or not. I do not recall seeing the Batman where Val Kilmer played Batman. I don't think I see.
Yeah.
I'm seeing all this Val Kilmer Batman stuff, and I'm like, I must have tapped out of the Batman franchise by that point.
Did he play Batman?
Well,
yeah.
My point. Like 95, I think it was.
No.
But.
What?
Now we're overlooking.
Yeah, that's my point. No one remembers.
I mean, it sounds familiar, but it.
Val Kilmer played Batman and Bruce Wayne in the which version? Batman.
Batman Forever.
Yep.
Oh yeah, it was Batman. It had Robin in it. That's the one.
That's the one with Chris. Chris.
It also had Jim Carrey as the Riddler.
Well, see, I did see that, but I guess did that have Alicia Silverstone in it too?
Yes, it did.
So that just goes to show you that Jim Carrey
that might make it
Silverstone
back, that
stole
might
the
make
show
it worth
so well that
watching.
We don't even remember Val Kilmer being in that movie.
That was the one with Tommy Lee Jones as Two-Face.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And Jim Carrey played the Riddler.
Yeah.
You just
I remember everybody but Val Kilmer being in that. How crazy
yeah.
is that?
Yeah.
I guess in my subconscious mind, that was just another Michael Keaton Batman.
Nicole Kidman was in it.
Mm-hmm.
Chris O'Donnell, I think he was the one.
Was Robin.
He played Robin.
You know what I remember from that movie?
Yeah.
I saw it in a theater.
Yeah, I remember that. Yep.
I remember the one scene I remember from that movie, saw it in a theater, and they made a dig at the 1963 Batman. I remember they got off of a submarine or a boat, and they stepped on this metal contraption in the water. And Robin goes, "Holy rusted metal, Batman!" And there was like, "Oh," he goes, "No, seriously, it's metal. It's rusty. It's full." It was like a dig at the 1965 Batman. That's the only thing from that movie. Holy rusted metal, Batman! And I was like, "Oh, bad joke." But yeah,
so
Kilmer passed away. He's been sick for years. I know when he was in Top Gun, it was primarily a lot of CGI.
Yeah, they were saying that most of his dialogue was AI because he had, I think he had throat cancer, and they had to give him a tracheotomy, and that messed up his vocal cords, and you know, so he was really raspy and rough.
In 2014,
65 is young.
In 2014, he had a tracheostomy done, I believe. And that was what basically the whole vocal thing, like you were saying.
USA Today, Val Kilmer caused the death. How pneumonia and throat cancer is their headline. Yeah.
I want to talk about
his
two good movies.
Is what movie?
I want to talk about his two good movies.
The Doors.
Real Genius.
Go ahead.
And Top Secret. If you haven't seen those two, fantastic.
Is that the one with the laser-driven popcorn popper?
No, that was Real Genius.
That was a fantastic movie. Now, that's a movie I can get behind.
Yeah, absolutely. But
wow, my microphone went like completely hot there.
Yeah, it did.
But Top Secret was like the greatest Naked Gun kind of spoof movie ever.
I remember
it was
that
just
now.
All bits and sight gags and stuff. Fantastically funny movie.
Yeah, I remember that now. Yep, I remember that. That science movie he was in was pretty, I mean, that was one of those movies at the time that just ran in perpetuity on HBO.
Oh yeah.
So as somebody who's been carrying a firearm for over 13 years daily, one of the biggest inconveniences is when you come home, you need to take your firearm off of yourself and put it somewhere safe, somewhere secure, especially if you have kids. Now, I know most of us are responsible. We have a gun safe somewhere, but let's be honest. Usually these gun safes are big, they're bulky, they're kind of out of the way because they're a bit of an eyesore. Your wife doesn't want them where everybody can see them. So sometimes they're in your closet behind some clothes, sometimes they're in the garage, sometimes they're in the mudroom. And let's be honest, taking your firearm out and walking to those locations to secure it is a pain in the butt, but you have to be a responsible firearm owner, especially if you have kids in the house. That's why you need to get yourself a StopBox Pro portable gun safe. You can make it non-portable, you can drill some holes in it, mount it to a place of convenience in your house, but it requires no batteries and no electricity. You simply come in your house, walk up to your safe, choose your finger button combinations, open a safe, remove your firearm from your person, put it in the safe. If you close your safe, just that easy, it's secure. So do yourself a favor, head over to StopBoxUSA.com/D410 and get all the information today on your StopBox Pro. When seconds count, trust the only non-fail firearm storage box, StopBox Pro, at StopBoxUSA.com/D410. Keep talking. I'm trying to get my microphone back to the level it was. I don't know why it shot. I had the balance really good and it just shot to the moon.
You went extremely hot, sir.
So I did.
So I'll I'll jump in here. I saw a little bit the other day. Apparently I missed it.
Apparently
I would have gone and seen it. Apparently. On the 26th of last month, Cypress Hill did a live basically the whole Black Sunday album with the London Symphony Orchestra. So the little clips of it I saw was pretty great, but they're actually going to release it on June 6th, a live album. And I think they're also going to release the concert footage too.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Was that in America? Did they play that at Radio City or something like
no,
that?
No, it was at the Royal Albert Hall.
Oh, Royal Albert, yeah. There's a lot of shit.
I'm not sure, but I heard that the Royal Albert Hall was full of holes.
The Royal Albert Hall was full of holes? Why?
That's a Beatles reference.
Is it?
How many holes does it take to fill the Albert Hall? So I can hear it now.
What song was it?
Can you hear this?
No.
Can't hear this?
No, it's just the voices in your head.
No, I'm playing Cypress Hill from the London Symphony that you're talking.
So, look this up real quick. Look up Sir Mix-a-Lot with the Seattle Symphony.
Seen it.
Uh-oh.
all the middle-aged white
chicks shaking. Yeah, yeah, totally, totally middle-aged white chicks
that
up twerking
girl,
while he's.
Girl, she's like, "Oh, this is my chance. I've been waiting my whole life. I grew up with a big ass, and now is my time to shine."
So, while you're looking that up, this kind of took me down a rabbit hole. Being a born and raised Northwest kid, most people would consider Sir Mix-a-Lot a one-hit wonder. But he actually had like 10 or 12 albums and was wildly successful in the Northwest.
I'm trying to get the scene where homegirl's up there shaking her ass. She's living her... Oh, here it is. Living her best life.
Okay, we got enough.
Oh, no.
That's what I was just watching.
Ellen DeGeneres. Something you may have... Your face who hit strong.
Oh, here. Oh, God. Oh, white girl wasted.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
that's what happens. That's what happens after like 8 Moscatos.
Yeah.
Girl in the front and the black is going bananas. He got down to that shit in middle school.
Oh my goodness.
Funny thing.
Oh no.
That was like all over the place.
That
was like the key of pop culture at that time.
Oh yeah.
You guys talk amongst yourself. I got to grab a book. I want to read a paragraph real quick.
No.
Oh, now we have to be all entertaining and stuff. I don't know if I've got it in me.
This sucks.
I don't want to be back. In charge. I just want to be the sidekick, man.
Yeah. We're the side pieces.
I want to be Guillermo, man. Leave me alone.
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, jeez.
I got some pretty decent news about my VA stuff. Which is pretty.
Oh, yeah?
Funny. Yeah. I had to find some extra paperwork and stuff like that. I finally found. Actually, I had to contact the National Archives.
Because
there was paperwork that I did not receive and I didn't know existed. So I was just, going through the motions. And they were like, well, contact the National Archive because they probably have it. I mean, they should have literally everything. I was like, okay. So I did. And when it took them a week and they finally got back to me and they emailed me and they had paperwork that I didn't realize existed. So I got all that information and I was like, wow. I was looking up like Army regulation codes and stuff like that for because they had a bunch of different codes on some of my paperwork and stuff like that. So I was trying to figure that out. So hopefully I'll be able to take this stuff down to the VA and they'll be able to get me situated. So
that'd
be sweet. So what are you doing there, fella?
I was trying to check your all's levels because it's like your all's got quiet too. It's like it's fucking Zoom's going all over the place.
You look like you're diddling your game.
Keep talking.
No.
Not
I don't want to.
Later, but yeah, because when I came in, Mike's volume was super quiet.
Really?
Well, we were just kind of having a chill conversation, NPR style.
Yeah, Morgan's is nice. Mine's good, but Mike's is quiet. Maybe he needs to turn up the mic on his side.
Excuse me.
Or
I don't
turn
know.
The
mine's
volume on your Zoom.
Mine's usually pretty loud.
You're good enough there, I guess.
Okay.
So I've been reading this.
1984.
You ever read this book, Morgan?
Great book.
This is a great book. You all should read it, particularly now. But I was reading it last night because now that I'm off my homework books for What's the Scuttlebutt, I've been reading book after book. But I came across this paragraph. I'm going to slaughter it, but deal with me. Just remember, I got a learning disability. But it kind of explains all you need to know about where we are in life. For those who don't know, this was written by a gentleman in 1954. He survived being a civilian through World War II in the United Kingdom and saw all the trappings that came along with that, saw politicians trying to grasp for power, saw how Hitler and Stalin and Mussolini and all them treated people. And this book, basically, the war went differently. And by, they think 1984, because they lost track of time because, well, they destroy history as it happens. By that point in the world, there's only three countries. The countries basically divided up all the landmass, okay? And so they really have nothing to fight for because the countries are now so big that each one of them has enough natural resources to accommodate all their needs. So there's really no reason to fight. But it doesn't mean that people are living happily. Listen to this. It kind of explains. This is written in 1954. But it was also clear that an all-around increase of wealth threatened the destruction. Indeed, in some sense, was the destruction of the hierarchy society. In a world which everyone worked short hours, had enough to eat, lived in a house with a bathroom, a refrigerator, and possessed a motor car, and even airplanes, the most obvious and perhaps the most important of the inequity would already have disappeared. If it once became general, wealth would confer no distinction. It was possible, no doubt, to imagine a society in which wealth and a sense of personal possessions and luxury should be evenly distributed, while power remained in the hands of the small privileged caste. But in practice, a society such could not long remain stable. For if leisure and security were enjoyed by all alike, the great masses of human beings who are normally stupefied by poverty would become literate and would learn to think for themselves. And when once they had done this, they would sooner or realize that the privileged minority had no function. And they would sweep it away. In the long run, the hierarchical society was only possible on the basis of poverty and ignorance. To return to an agricultural past, as some thinkers often think about the beginning of the 20th century dreamed of doing, was not a practical solution. And so what he's talking about, in this world, you have these three countries that no longer need to fight with one another. He's saying all three countries are so powerful that the other two ganged up, they wouldn't be able to win. So there was a stalemate. And so the way they control their people, right? Because if you have everything you need, you have a harmonious society, right? Equilibrium. Everybody's working, everybody's producing, everybody has what they need to produce and to sell. And if all three countries have all the things they need, there's no need to invade, right? I don't need to invade you because I have enough oil, I have enough steel, I have enough food, everything's fine. We all work inside our little bubble perfectly. And if we want, we could trade for some technology. Well, if you have three countries running the whole world that are all working in harmony and no one has needs, then what do you need government for? Because government's job is to protect you and to provide security and logistics. Well, if you actually have three countries that everybody's figured out what they need to do to have success, you no longer have need for government. And you no longer need to have those in power. And so how they resolved this amongst these three countries in this book is they basically fought wars over four little countries that they used for slave labor. And they needed the war to destroy, to expend the products in which they made, right? Because you can't make stuff for people to buy to have a luxury life because they no longer need your government. But if all of your production went to war goods and you have barely had enough money for, you know, everything went to war goods in this book. So every single person's living like a slave. They're all broke as shit. They're eating gruel because these power hungry governments where the politicians are in charge, living high on the hog. Oh, we're in war with the boogeyman. We're in war with the boogeyman. Well, they weren't in war. It was a made up war so that they only manufactured goods for the war so that they can blow them up and destroy them, thus make more. Otherwise, they would make luxury items and then people would no longer need a government. And so, but the reason this is so important, the whole the whole basis on how these governments do it is they destroy history in real time. The main character's job in this is to take history as it happens, rewrite it in a fictional way, and then delete the original copies. And I've said on What's the Scuttlebutt for since 2018, but history books always need to be in paper form. People talk about, oh, we don't need paper books anymore. Go online books, digital books. Digital books can be edited on the fly. You want to do that for your fiction books, that's fine. Historical books need to be hard copied so they can't be deleted in real time. And more importantly, they have thought police. And if you think the wrong thing, the thought police show up your door and you fucking die and disappear. And the other thing they have is what they call new think, where they're literally deleting the vocabulary. They find syllables, nouns, all that stuff is a waste in the economy of words. And so they come up with a new word that represents six other words so that people, you reduce the words, you reduce the meaning, you reduce people's ability to think and have their own ideas. And so they, not only are they deleting history, they're deleting vocabulary and coming up with new definitions, you know, like LGBT and trans this and, you know, this and that. And we see it all the time where old words get new meanings, right? And this guy basically came up with all this shit out of his head in 1954 after he watched communism and socialism and all that in real time. And you're reading this, much like Atlas Shrugged, and you're like, that's happening? That's happening? I remember when I read Atlas Shrugged in 2008, I'm like, that's happening? That's happening? It's so crazy how these fiction books written by people who survived and lived as young adults through World War II, the things they come up with, it's like, oh, yeah. That's what certain people are trying to do now. They're trying to control people by, you don't need to work. Here's some checks. Here's the bare minimum. Let's change the vocabulary a little bit. We don't want you to have thought. We don't want you to decide whether or not you're getting a vaccination or not. You just need to get it and shut the fuck up. And it's kind of crazy. But yeah, when I read that, I was like, that explains it all. You can't have
novel. The novel 1984 was written by George Orwell in 1948. Yep.
Oh, 1948. I think
published in 1949.
Okay, yeah, this made reference to 1954 in the beginning, maybe because that was one of the copyrights. But yeah, 1948. Well,
I was curious because I was looking him up, and he actually died in 1950. So
yeah, so maybe that's what it was. Yeah, but so 2 years after the war, and yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, what's that called, too? Because it's 1948, but the novel is called 1984.
1984, yeah.
Yeah. What's that called when you can reverse stuff like that?
Otto is one on The Simpsons.
It's not an onomatopoeia, is it?
I think so. In the Otto. What it is? It may be different for numbers, but yeah, I think Otto on The Simpsons is one. But I would strongly recommend reading that book.
Yeah, that sounds like it. I think we've talked about that before. That sounds like a good read.
Problem is
another good read is
Atlas Shrugged. Both have become politicized because obviously the people on a certain side don't want you to read books that show that their mentality is insane. So they tend to politicize. Oh, you don't want to read that. You're a right wing nut if you read 1984. Okay, fella.
So, Fahrenheit 451.
Heard about
another good one. What's that?
He also wrote Animal Farm. You guys have heard Animal.
I've yeah.
Heard, same guy.
And Harrison Bergeron is another good one. Kind of relates to our current thing about trying to make everybody equal.
I should probably start reading more. I don't read that much. I didn't read that much in school.
I
read because I had to.
I won't go too much into it because I've covered it so many times in WTSP, but I didn't start reading until 2003 when I was like 22. Obviously, with a learning disability, I hated reading, and I hated reading in school, but some moron made a mistake and gave me, a guy who doesn't read, not even comic books. Comic books was a bridge too far for me.
Sure.
They gave me a Books a Million gift card for Christmas. This, you might as well give me a gift card to fucking Bath and Body Works or Victoria's Secret. So I was flying home from Kentucky to LA. No, going from LA to Kentucky to visit my mom. And so I was at the LAX and I was wandering around. Now, at the time,
rewind 2 years. Remember, Band of Brothers came out on 9/11, right around 9/11. And I just got an HBO, but I was broke. It's right on my divorce. And so I did, as we all did back in the early 2000s, I just went on fucking LimeWire and downloaded the shit. And so when I moved to California, I was living in my dad's spare bedroom. I would just watch Band of Brothers on that old ass computer. You guys seen my compact Presario with the 2 megahertz PCP, you know, 256 meg CPU and 128 megs of RAM.
The custom window.
And I still have the book. I was walking around the little bookstore at LAX, and I found Beyond Band of Brothers. No, it's the story of actually, I'm looking right at it now. Brothers in Arms, Best of Friends. It was the Wild Bill Garnier and Babe Heffern story from Band of Brothers. And so I bought that, and I read it on the plane. I said, holy shit, reading's not too bad when it's something you actually have an interest in, because in school, yeah, you don't have an interest in shit, and your parents are trying to, I don't want to read that. I can't read anyhow. And who would have known 22 years later I would be interviewing Wild Bill Garnier's son and granddaughter on my show?
Right.
Who would have thought that I would be interviewing authors, which, by the way, if you guys head over to patreon.com and sign up, you're entered to win. This April's giveaway is the Houdini Club. We just interviewed him. This episode will be up. I think I've interviewed 20 authors now. I have an entire goddamn library in here, and I leisure read for fun. So if you hate reading and you haven't read since school and you're an adult now, pick up a book. You might surprise yourself.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of nice to turn off the social media and do like your grandpappy did. Read on the toilet instead of swipe. You'll be happy. Why I have toilet paper as bookmarks.
See, and that's the kind of books that I end up really diving into was always like autobiography type books. And specifically, I'd have to say about like the music industry and stuff like that, because I was so entranced in music and like playing the drums when I was growing up and stuff like that. So
thank you for reminding me. Before the first novel I read, actually, before I moved to California, right before I moved, my roommate had Heavier Than Heaven, which was Kurt Cobain's biography. I read that.
Okay.
And then I think I read Marilyn Manson's biography. But other than that, those were the only two books I leisure read, just because they're available to me. But yeah,
the ones that I had picked up was I own a physical copy of Behind the Paint. Mm-hmm. That was given to me as a birthday gift, and I started to physically read it, and then I was like, I don't want to tear it up because it's like, you know, sentimental to me or whatever. So I listened to the audio version of that, and he actually read it and whatnot, you know, through and through. So I did, you know, understand the story of that up until like whatever it was, 2003 or four, whenever the book actually came out. And then like an additional, like when he did the audiobook version of it, like an additional like 5 to 10 years after the book had already come out, like he put on like this little extra after the fact, like a chapter fucking 18 or 19 or something like that about it. But anyway, that one. And then if you haven't read it, and I don't know if you like the band or care for the band or not, it's actually a lot more interesting. The Heroin Diaries by Nikki Sixx.
I haven't read that. I did read, but yeah, no, I haven't read that one. And to Mike's point, 98% of my books, obviously the World War II, but even still, there are biography or autobiography. To me, it's more interesting to read crazy shit that really happened to someone opposed to make-believe shit. But
yeah,
this is historical fiction. But and so, yeah, if you don't like reading, try reading a biography, especially crazy survival story, a mountain climbing story.
Reading about something that actually happened. Like, you know, that's the kind of stuff that I like, is like, and especially stuff either like right before I was born, like, you know, probably in your guys's era, like in this, you know, 60s, 70s and 80s.
Back in the old days.
You know, around the time that, you know, because my dad was born in 61. So I like to learn about a lot of stuff that happened when he was around, you know, when he was a younger man, and, you know, my mother and, you know, stuff like that. But even stuff like around when I was a kid, because it's something that I can go, wow, when I was, you know, 5 years old, such and such happened. And, you know, that was the kind of shit that was going on. It kind of goes hand in hand with watching like documentaries and stuff too.
Yep.
it kind of, you know, kind of ties in with that as well. So
if you want a reason to read, just go watch the latest episode of How I Heard It, the Mike Rowe podcast, where he's talking to Tim Allen. Holy fuck. Tim Allen is more than just craftsman jokes.
Yeah.
The dude was a philosophy major. That interview, you're just like, holy shit, I need to read more. These two guys, the knowledge base that they have. Tim Allen, like, he's to this day, he's actively like hanging out with like philosophy professors and engineers and shit.
Yeah.
He's wicked, wicked smart. So yeah, just go listen to that. I wanted to bring this story.
Did you know that Mike Rowe is an opera singer?
He is, yeah. He's a bad motherfucker too. He's awesome.
Yeah.
I fucking love Mike Rowe. He's the shit.
The way his podcast originally started, because I've been listening to episodes since episode one, back during the pandemic, he would do reverse stories in the stylings of like Paul Harvey would do it. He would start talking about somebody and all the shit they're doing. And his name was Steve Gutenberg. That's the way I heard it. You're like, holy shit. You know, he would tell these outlandish stories. And that's the story of how Betty Crocker made her first brand. Like, what the fuck? And they're very cool. Now he's doing long format interviews with people, but it's, yeah, he goes back and talking about how he got his start doing QVC at 2 a.m. selling like moon crystal necklaces and shit. That's how he got his start, was doing QVC live at like at 3 a.m. and would
do calls
from people.
There was actually another, you know, kind of diving into the music world a little bit again is he's not really a new artist. I mean, his album's been out for some of the songs he's written and they've been on YouTube for a couple of years, but he actually didn't put out an album until like 2023 or whatever. He was a songwriter in Nashville for quite a few years, but that Steven Wilson Jr., who's becoming extremely popular because of his Live at the Print Shop, song that he did the rendition of Stand By Me.
Okay.
And that kind of blew up on TikTok there for a little bit. And like now everybody's finding him. What's interesting about him, a little bit of backstory. He grew up in Indiana. He grew up like right down the street from who's one of the big like bulky kind of artist from freaking Indiana. What the hell was his name?
Tom Petty?
John Cougar?
Cougar, yeah. Mellencamp. He grew up like right down the street, like knows his entire family. And he tells this story, basically like all these songs and everything came up because his dad passed away. I think it's been six or seven years ago now. And he wrote all these songs basically for his dad. And his album is called Son of Dad because he is a junior. And kind of, you know, he what he likes to dive into is, you know, all the, you know, some of the things that he, you know, grew up and, you know, the things that his father taught him and stuff like that. But what's interesting is that him and his father were polar opposites. His dad worked on cars and was like a real rugged, like out, you know, outdoorsy kind of, you know, you fix it yourself kind of guy from, you know, the country. And here's his kid, just this nerdy little fucking kid that was very interested in like science and stuff like that, was not interested in like working, like, you know, doesn't change tires and shit like that. Right. And even further, like he grew up like the only thing that they really had in common was they did the Golden Gloves of America, the boxing, you know, amateur boxing championship and whatnot. And he could have been a professional boxer.
Could have been somebody. He could have been a contender.
And he ended up like he followed his science career. He went to like a 4-year college to become a scientist. Basically, he had his own lab. He had an office and everything for the Mars company, the candy, you know, the Mars bars and stuff. And he said on a podcast one time. He said on a podcast one time, believe it or not, the dog, I guess treat or whatever you would call it, dentist sticks.
Yep,
that's what he came up with. That's like one of his babies, as he called it.
So my dad worked at Calcan in Columbus. That's where he got his first, which is owned by Mars. You know who else worked at that same cow can shortly before him?
Who that?
Motherfucking Dwight Yoakam.
Really?
He also worked for the Mars Company at Calcan in Columbus before he became a singer. He worked at Calcan as well.
That's cool.
This is a little segment we like to do where we keep Mike in a corner because he can't relate. This is where we talk to the Gen Xers.
What the fuck?
I'm going to list off 10 songs.
Let the adults speak now, Mike.
Oh, fuck both of you guys.
Little kids table. It's Thanksgiving time. We're going to, us Gen Xers, we're going to talk to each other. I'm going to blow your mind. Morgan, I wouldn't put it past you to know this, but I'm going to read a 10 song title just because Mike brought up music. And I want you to tell me who wrote the lyrics for these 10 songs. And we'll start from the hardest to the easiest. Tom Pell Glaster's Put Another Log on the Fire, which became the male chauvinist national anthem. Lester Flatt's February Snow. Kris Kristofferson's Son of a Scoundrel. John Prime's This Guitar is for Sale. Buck Owens on the cover of the Music City News. Emily Harris's Queen of the Silver Dollar. And now you'll start recognizing more of these. Waylon Jennings' The Taker. Bobby Bear's Sylvester's Mother. Loretta Lynn's One Way, or I'm sorry, One's on the Way. So that's Loretta Lynn's One on the Way. And number one, Johnny Cash, A Boy Named Sue. Who wrote all of the? I know y'all thought Johnny Cash wrote A Boy Named Sue, but he didn't.
Was that Willie?
Listen to, no. The title, kind of think of the stylings of the names of these titles. I'll just read the titles again. A Boy Named Sue, One on the Way, Sylvester's Mother, The Taker, Queen of a Silver Dollar, on the cover of Music City News, This Guitar is for Sale, Son of a Scoundrel, February Snow, and Put Another Log on the Fire. I'll give you a hint, Morgan. You'll never know that this guy was a music writer, but I goddamn guarantee you and everybody in your elementary school checked his books out at the school library.
Dr. Seuss.
What if I would say Where the Sidewalk Ends?
Oh, Michelle Silverstein. Okay.
All those songs.
You know what? Now that you said that, I do remember hearing A Boy Named Sue that he wrote that.
Yeah. But... Not only was he a prolific, I don't even, would it be fair to say that he was a children's poem writer, or do you think his styling of writings just appealed to us? Because I don't know if I would call Where the Sidewalk Ends, or what was the other one? Something in the like the Room in the Mind or some shit. The Window in the Brain or whatever.
Something in the Attic or something.
Books. I remember those were the ones we all waited to get at the library.
I think it was probably just more like the poetry of the times. And... you know, it just happened to appeal to kids.
Are you, did Shel Silverstein light, carry over your generation? Attic. Yeah, light in the attic. So you had Falling Up.
Yes.
Sidewalk Ends, The Giving Tree.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff. A lot of those books, I mean, I don't remember like Book Report or anything like that, but there were... I don't remember specifically reading any of those, but I do remember seeing those covers like either in the library or I would see them like somebody would check it out or something like that. I vaguely remember checking out one of them, but I couldn't tell you which one it was. And I don't even remember anything about it. There goes my dog in the background.
Here's what I love about Gen X and our parents. We hear all the time now that, you know, the poor abused kids of today, you know, they have it so hard, you know. Hey, little boy, you know, dealing with your homosexuality, come talk to my aunt who came out of the closet in Kentucky in 1979. She knows what it's a hard time of being gay was, okay? You're in 2024, you don't have a hard time. But here's how crazy our grandparents and our parents were when we were growing up. A Light in the Attic was banned by some schools because the parents believed his poem would make their kids break all the dishes so they wouldn't have to dry them. That's all it took back, ladies and gentlemen.
Is that like banning Looney Tunes because I'm going to stand on a cliff and drop an anvil on somebody's head?
Or when they, oh, Mike, you don't remember this. This is before your time. There was a campaign. Beavis and Butthead in the later seasons had to stop going fire, 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 because they said that it was going to cause kids to start fires in their homes.
Really?
Yeah. Let's see here. A Light in the Attic. From the sidewalk ends up to the light in the attic, Shel Silverstein's books were filled with eccentric allusions and quirky rhyme poetry that made readers of all ages giggle. But parents in Wisconsin weren't laughing when they read one of the poems in Light in the Attic, How Not to Have to Dry the Dishes, the poem goes. If you have to dry the dishes, such an awful boring chore. If you have to dry the dishes, instead of going to the store. If you have to dry the dishes and you drop one on the floor, maybe then you won't have to do the dishes anymore. I got to say, at 45 reading that, I'm not that fucking impressed. I can't believe this is the guy who wrote Boy Named Sue. That clearly was that. I wouldn't mark that up as a literary masterpiece.
Hey, but yeah. Fun fact for you. Right here off of old Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
In 1957, Silverstein became one of the leading cartoonists in Playboy, which sent him around the world to create an illustrated travel journal with reports of far-flung locales.
Since we're going on the whole on children's books,
And it just says, during the 1950s and 60s, he produced 23 installments called Shel Silverstein Visits as featured for Playboy, employing a sketchbook format with typewriter-styled captions. He documented his own experiences at such locations as a Pennsylvania naturist community, the Chicago White Sox training camp, San Francisco's Haight Ashbury,
Haight Ashbury,
Fire Island, Mexico, London, Paris, Spain, and Africa.
And it's crazy to think that, you know, in our oversaturated world where you can look up anything, that, you know, London was a completely, like, far away place. Yeah, you know, and now you can turn on the BBC channel on Roku and, you know, have it in your living room 24 hours a day. Nuts to me.
Here's something that Mike won't also remember. School sponsored pen pal programs.
Internet,
we didn't have internet. There was a school sponsored, they would get you some
one time
or somebody from Britain or Zimbabwe to open up a channel of pen pal, and they would teach you the proper way to pen a letter. And I still write my emails in the proper way. Hello, sir, comma, space.
One time I wrote a pen pal letter. Just once.
In prison doesn't count.
I never got a response. I don't even know if they actually did anything with it, but we sat down in class in like my elementary school, whatever grade I was in, and I wrote one pen pal letter, and they were supposed to send it off to wherever the fuck, probably Africa or something like that, that we were learning about. But
that's what he thought.
Pen pal,
a letter to Santa.
How long is your sentence? When you get out, I would like to have ice cream with you. Yeah. Love, Mike.
Thanks for the previous letter. I'm not sure why you asked me if I had hair on my legs yet, but...
Oh, that's so bad.
I got that creepy phone call. Fourth grade. People think the pedos are running rampant now. No, I remember like 7 in the morning. My parents are gone. Some creepy dude called, you got hair on your legs?
Dear Puff Daddy.
Yeah, right? Let's go for lighthearted subjects. Some of our favorite subject: government misspending and misappropriation of funds. We all know what is the key role of parking tickets. Anyone? Anyone?
Revenue generation.
No, safety.
Money.
Yeah. It's free money, right? Fun fact.
Yeah, revenue generation.
2008, the city of Chicago was so broke and so desperate, they sold the rights to for the next 80 years of their parking meters to a hedge fund that's controlled primarily by companies out of the Arab Emirates. So they, and they're trying to buy it back because they're so broke, but it's a non-money winning proposition. LA, how much money do you think LA generates roughly annually a year off of parking tickets?
$1.2 billion.
That's a little high.
Billion?
That's
I mean, high.
It's in the millions.
I mean it.
The high millions.
Hundreds.
Each year, Los Angeles hands out roughly
675.
Each year, Los hands out roughly two million parking tickets. So they hand out 2 million. They generate roughly $110 million annually.
Jesus.
In parking ticket revenue. Now, when you're processing $110 million, 100, for the people in the back, $110 million in 12 months, you need a department of people to write the tickets, process the tickets, and to take payments on said tickets, mail them out, etc., etc. How much money do you think the city of Los Angeles spends a year in salary for the people to man the department responsible for writing, generating, collecting, and processing parking tickets at $110 million? A year.
$210 million.
I was gonna say, I'm either gonna guess is way over or extremely under. It's not gonna be anywhere close to it.
It can't be a net positive, I can tell you that.
What do you got?
Keep in mind, this is the same city where they think McDonald's employees should be making $25 an hour. Los Angeles. And 12 months generates a little over $110 million with payroll, medical care, vacation, and pensions. It costs them only $176 million to run the department.
Yahtzee!
I wasn't too far off.
It costs them $173 million to process $110 million of free fucking revenue.
$63 million net loss. I love it.
A net loss on collecting free money. You keep in mind, LA is to the point now where their parking meters have scales under them, so they know when you leave. When you leave, and you got an hour left on the meter, do you think they're going to let you give that hour to the next fella?
No.
Resets. And they're losing fucking money. When your government is so poorly ran that you lose money processing free money, that's a problem.
Well, you're just...
Incredible.
You're just spending money. That's all it is. That's all it is. At the end of the day, you're just spending money.
And you know goddamn well they're not employing 500,000 people to take your money in person. I'm sure if we looked into it, 83% of these tickets are paid online. So it's not like they got to pay the salary of people to man the registers to process your tickets.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm curious about is, out of that $110 million in parking tickets, what the percentage that's actually paid is.
Well, let's ask ChatGPT. Let me log in so I can get a quality answer here.
I mean, I know eventually they'll suspend your registration and stuff like that. So, you know, you can't register your car if you don't pay them. But I bet you it's only like 60 or 70% of them that get paid. The other 30% or 30 or 40 are outstanding.
Let's see. What is the percentage of parking tickets paid in LA County out of all the tickets written? Determining the exact percentage of parking tickets paid in LA County is challenging due to yada, yada, yada. Let's see. While in some cities like Austin, Texas have reported nearly a quarter of parking tickets issued between 2018 and 2019 are unpaid, similar details, data for Los Angeles County is not publicly available. Figure that one out. Therefore, without specific figures, yada, yada, yada. Due to, so we... LA keeps that shit close to the vest, but we can tell you that.
Well, if Austin has 25% unpaid,
we can assume LA County are probably 45%. So, so if Morgan was the mayor with his big D, he'd be like, well, it's not our fault. If everybody would pay their parking tickets, we wouldn't be in the net negative.
Well, being a former tow truck driver, I would just be out there impounding cars, every day until people paid their tickets.
Included too. I'm sure in Ohio, you would get a bench warrant for unpaid speeding tickets. In Columbus, you got a speeding ticket?
Oh.
When I got a speeding ticket down here, I was scared of it. I called to count. How long? I just realized I forgot to pay that speeding ticket. We don't do bench warrants down here, sir. Fuck you. No, they just... That's what Florida does. I have my license suspended because I forgot to pay a fucking toll. That's what they do down here. You don't pay the license, they that $2 toll turns into $250, and then they take your license.
So
yeah,
I got my license suspended once because I filled out an accident report form wrong. I put my insurance information on the line below where it should have gone. I got pulled over for a California stop. They impounded my car and, put me on the street walking. Cost me $400 to get my car out of impound. Plus I had to, pay all of this other, reinstatement fees and everything. It cost me like almost a grand to get my license back.
Burns, I would feel sorry for you, but seeing how you were the man, you used to tow everybody else's car for parking in the fucking Winn-Dixie parking lot overnight. You got your
job. Hey.
I came back and bitching your ass.
Well, that was actually before, so I took my rage out on other people who did wrong.
Despite all my rage, my microphone keeps going up and down in volume.
See, that's also why I bit the bullet. I mean, I didn't really bite much of a bullet. It wasn't that expensive, but I got the fucking SunPass. I got both stickers. I registered the account. I got all my license plates with the exception of my boat and my trailer. For the boat, but literally everything is all on that account, and I have, a set limit. I check it every now and again. I throw a few bucks on it because I'll be the guy. I'll be the fucking guy that it'll show up in the mail, and I know it showed up in the mail, but it'll end up in here in the office, and I won't see it, and I'll forget to pay it for whatever stupid fucking reason because I just didn't get to it right away, and then I'll be getting a notice in the mail or some stupid shit.
Well, I'll tell you what the killer is. I keep getting... toll by plate.
Yeah.
And there's a way that you can tie it to your SunPass account. And I think that my $2.50 toll is now like a $30 toll because I've put it off for so long. Yeah. Just trying to get it tied to my SunPass account.
Well, I think the only thing that you really have to do is put in your make, model, and year and all that shit. And then just add your license plate. And I did that multiple times. And I thought that my account was set up so that it would automatically draw from my bank account to replenish funds or just draw through SunPass directly to my bank account. And there were times I went through the toll and then naturally 30 days later, I got a thing and I was like, what the fuck? Like this, it's, it's on my account. Like, what's the problem? And I guess you actually have to make sure that you have a balance on there too, because if you don't have money on the account, they're not going to draw it from
I've got like 30 bucks on mine.
When
I had at computers, we had it, but now I make so many few trips over there that I'd rather just get the letter in the mail and pay the $250 on the website and be done with it.
But see, I go to Orlando kind of regularly, so
You're one of those kind of rich dudes that
Mickey Mouse
goes up to the theme parks all the time, huh?
Oh yeah, one of those rich dudes who has a brother that works there. it doesn't mind, you know, tossing him a bone every now and again.
I had a profound thought when I was reading that passage yesterday, and I wonder what you guys think.
Yeah,
they say that money is the root of all evil.
Sure.
You know what the root of all evil truly, the basis of everything negative in life comes down to?
What's that?
Someone taking something from someone else. List me any sort of thing that horrible happens that's not boiled down. Somebody like rape. Rape is the ultimate expression of taking something from somebody, right?
Oh, murder.
You taking someone's life, rape, taking someone's free will, taking someone's choice to have sex with you, taking someone's innocence. Mm-hmm. Everything horrible in life comes down to someone trying to take something from something else. And that's literally you can't think of anything negative that doesn't boil down to that in some way, shape, or form. I mean, try to come up with something that doesn't, the end result is you taking something.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. I mean, we could probably sit here for hours and try to figure out something that ultultimately doesn't go down that path. But
well, yeah, it really is totally hate sense. And malice.
Yeah, greed.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, and it's, I don't know. I mean, I think that it's just the evil inside of people.
It's just, but the most evil thing, you read the commandments.
Yeah.
Coveting a neighbor's wife, taking his wife, wanting their property, taking their cow. You know, everything literally comes down to taking from somebody, taking one person, taking from something else. Robbing a store. What are you doing? Taking their shit. Robbing someone's home. Killing somebody. Literally, everything boils down to taking. And if we can just figure out how to get people to stop trying to take other people's shit, all the problems go away. That is the downfall of society, that we can't get to the point where we can all agree not to try to take other people's shit.
Well, when somebody has a bigger TV or a nicer car or more money or whatever, and it really boils down to, well, I mean, not quite to the level that you're talking about, but it does boil down to, we've got this society where martyrdom and victimhood is, you know, is almost celebrated. And it's like, you deserve to liberate that 75-inch TV from Best Buy, you know, during the peaceful protests, because why should that corporation have a 75-inch TV and you don't? So I don't know. I
think that, in my opinion, that is a very, if we're getting kind of political here, that's a very liberal type of mentality too.
It's not even liberal. It's more a borderline on communist and socialist. Cause after all, the root definition, and they say it a lot in the book, Atlas Shrugged. And that is they're saying is the needs of the many outweigh those of the few.
Well, I mean, Spock even said that in you know, Star Trek, what was it, 2? You know, as he's dying in the radiation, you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. So,
but that is the backbone of communism. Hey,
it is, you know, to each according to his needs, from each according to his abilities. You know, I mean, is the basic tenet of socialism. And, you know, that only works to a certain degree. And then, you know, just like you're reading in 1984, you know, you've got the masses getting just enough to cover their needs, barely giving enough, everything that they've got, you know, productivity wise. And then you've got the small, the small group of political leaders that are living fat. I mean, if you look at the Soviet Union, you know, during the 70s and 80s, you see, you know, if you were doing well, you got a lot of Riva, which, you know, basically was a licensed Fiat 124 sedan that, you know, you were rolling pretty good. But you get the guy that's in charge of your town who's driving a Mercedes 500.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, and most people are lucky if they can get a decent pair of shoes and, you know, a couple of beets to make some borscht.
And we see that modern day too. We see all these areas where the Red Cross will go drop off food and clothing in these third world countries, and their police, their military, their politicians will take it for themselves. And then the people actually starving out in the villages getting none of it. And we see
that was huge in the 80s and 90s with all the relief that, you know, Band-Aid and We're the World and all that, you know, raised billions and billions of dollars. And it all ended up in warehouses, basically, you know, hijacked by warlords. Mm-hmm. And very little, if any of it, made it to the people that actually were starving to death that we all thought we were helping.
We'll wrap up the show on a question. Mike, how old is your cell phone? The easiest way to know is what version is it and what's the newest version. I have an S21 Plus. They're currently on the S25.
Mine is a iPhone 15 Pro Max. I think 17 comes out this year, so a couple of years.
Morgan?
Mine's probably about 3 years old. Mine is a Motorola Stylus 5G because I don't do – well, I mean, I've got an iPhone for work, but I don't do iPhones. I don't do Galaxies. I paid $199 for this phone off of Amazon. So, and I got to do it again because I've managed to totally destroy the screen.
I'm trying to download an image here so that I can open it. You guys might be able to see it. I have an S21 Plus. They're coming out the S25. I'm trying to get a white page on here, but you guys aren't going to be able to see it because even Google now has crap on there. At the bottom of my phone, can't really see it, but there's a pink square with a cross in the middle. Mm-hmm. To the left, there's a little pink house. And as an IT guy, even my boss said, I didn't know screen burn was a thing. My phone is so old that I have the toolbar of TikTok screen burn in my fucking phone. I have the house and the plus. I don't know if you guys, I'm trying to get it. Yeah, you can have a see it there a little bit. See the cross in the middle?
Yeah.
You can see the house?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the plus and the house on the left. Yeah.
I have screen burn. I don't know if it's from live streaming. And you spend too much time on your phone.
It can't be from live streaming because that goes away when you live stream.
So I check my digital well-being. How many hours a day do you spend on your phone, Mike? If you check it, you know how to go to digital well-being? Android. On the Android, go to settings and just go to digital well-being.
Ours would be screen time.
They call it digital well-being for us Android users because they care about us, unlike your corporate shell. You know, because Google, they're the good guy. Did you find it, Morgan? Go to settings.
Well-being. Yeah, I...
Now, I would expect yours is going to be rather high, seeing how your current, you know, where you're entertaining yourself after work. Mike, what's your daily cell phone usage? Now, this for those playing at home. To be fair, this includes tap to pay.
To be fair.
Anything to use your phone for.
So today, April 2nd, apparently as up to date as it can be. Oh, wait a minute. Okay. 3 hours and 38 minutes.
I'm trying to get a weekly overview, but I can give you today as well. Morgan, what's your daily usage?
4 hours, 27 minutes.
So the guy with the screen burn on his phone has 2 hours and 1 minute for today. I've actually been keeping my daily, and that includes tap to pay, listening to podcasts in my car, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so I can give you a rundown here.
20 minutes. Go ahead.
Sunday was five hours and 52 minutes. Monday was 4 hours and 32 minutes. And yesterday was 4 hours and 42.
So
So I spend about 4.5 hours a day.
out of my 2 hours today, 20 minutes was messaging. 13 minutes a day using 2FA authenticator on my phone to log into shit at work. That's how much I have an entire app because anytime I log into my client servers, I have to. And that, and by the way, I've moved to a different app, and so that's just a few that I got to do. 13 minutes a day on 2FA log. I only spent 51 minutes today on TikTok. But yeah, and so I don't know if it's an older cat thing, but I mean, I know some of our younger techie people, they're getting new phones like every year. And part of the reason I haven't got a new phone is I don't want to go through the hassle of moving all my 2FA and all that crap over. But I'm starting to use my cell phone as much as my GoPros now, so I'm contemplating getting a new cell phone just for the camera aspect for all the content I'm shooting, which we'll talk about. I think next week's episode, if the timing falls right, I think we're going to do an episode of What's in Your Head that's going to fall over to Failed to Fail. Me and Mike are going to give you guys a little sneak peek. I signed up for something really stupid that could potentially take me 8 hours, and we're going to film it. I'm going to be doing my first backyard ultra marathon. If I complete it, I will be running a 50K. And what an ultra marathon. The reason they call it backyard ultra marathon is because it's done in loops. So instead of running from point A to point B and having to cover a lot of ground, which requires a lot of city permits and a lot of rental shit, you get like a state park. And so I'm going to be doing potentially four 10K loops. That's 6 miles every loop. Now, the good news is the race ends in 8 hours. And if you do the math, that's a 17-minute mile. My leisure runs are 13 minutes on. I run 3 nights a week. Every night I run a 5K. So like last night, actually last night I ran a 10K last night. I ran 6 miles last night. And so the cool thing is I can run super slow. If I ran a, I think I did the math with ChatGPT. I definitely am shooting for a hell of a lot faster than 8 hours. I would like to do 5.5, maybe 6. But let's say I decided let's just have fun with this and go 8 hours. That means I only had to run a 16-minute mile, and that gives me 20 minutes to relax between each loop. And so it's less of a speed thing and more of an endurance thing. And another secret I'll tell you about ultra marathon, because I've been watching ultra marathons on YouTube for like the last 3 years. Actually, if you get a fail to fail, I had Jeff Peltier. He's a huge YouTuber. The guy does 200-mile ultra marathons. Most ultra
Good God.
marathoners run for a maximum of 10 minutes at a stretch. It's a lot of speed walking and hiking.
Really?
So that's the good news is you're not, unless you're trying to win the fucking thing, if your goal is just to finish it. And the cool thing is this backyard marathon is a little extra fun. You have to carry a horseshoe through the lap to show that you completed the lap. Now, I don't know if the horseshoes build, meaning lap two, you got to carry two horseshoes. Horseshoes aren't exactly light. I think, you know, what's the average weight of a horseshoe? 2 pounds?
Probably.
So you're going to be adding weight.
Two or three, yeah.
So anyhow, Mike's going to go as my crew, so that, you know, as I get slower, as the day goes on, it gets hotter and my 20 minutes narrows down like 5.5, he can make sure my water bottles get filled up and help me get my nutrition in balance. But more importantly, we are teaming up with Apex Promotions, who put these races on, and we're filming content. And so let's say I do these four, and it's a trail run, by the way, too. This isn't running down the street. This is running through, I don't even terrain. Know. I could be running through swamps. I could be running. So I got to bring my trail running shoes. I actually gonna bring two pairs of shoes. When I do my first lap, I'm going to go out under the mind state that I'm running through mud, debris, and everything else. And if I do that lap, say, okay, this is a dry, relatively sand course, I might switch from my trail running shoes to a more universal shoe. But I'm going to go out in that first loop like I did for my adventure race, where I had my gaiters on and everything else prepared for an OCR event, and we'll see what happens. But since Mike will have roughly an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes between time he sees me, he can walk around, get some B-roll. Maybe if he feels open to it, he can interview other crew members and, you know, get footage of what's happening when I'll have camera showing you what it's like to do this. And the longest registered race I ever ran was a half marathon, but the longest distance I ran in general, 17 miles. Which would be half of a marathon, a little over half. So cool thing is if I only make it to 25 miles, that's still a personal record for me, because that's a marathon. I've never ran a full marathon distance, but my goal is to do the full 31 miles. Question is, how long is it going to take? And Mike and I need to talk about whether we're going to do a rock star thing and just drive up there early in the morning, or get a camping site the night before. The state park's already full. The one campground I found today is not exactly cheap, but we'll talk about that off the air. So that's going to come up. Once I complete that, we'll do a joint episode to post on Failed to Fail. So that's coming up. So yeah, that ought to be fun.
Fucking A.
I think Mike will be intrigued on just seeing people. Cause that's how I kind of got into this. To me, it was crazy to watch. Obviously, the ones I'm watching, people are doing like 100 miles, which is far more than 31, but you got to crawl before you can walk. But just seeing what people go through to get that shit done is crazy. And when you run 16 miles, I'm sure you guys know, you guys had to do some long forest marches back in the military. You have a lot of time to process and think.
Fucking right you do.
And when you're maintaining like a decent speed, it's different for everybody, but if you actually maintain a certain pace, my 30s, I think for me personally, it was if I did between 7 and 8 miles at 9-minute miles consistently, that's when I hit my runner's high. I remember one day I came back from running a 12-mile race. Carrie thought I'd been out drinking because I came back that fucking loopy from the endorphins in my mind. Wow, so I'm questioning. I might even just let Mike edit the video, because depending on how crazy shit goes, I might like want to cut shit out. But by having Mike do it, I won't be able to self-censor. Like if I do embarrassing shit, because you never know. You never know at mile fucking 27. Oh,
we're raw and uncut.
Yeah. Man. So it'll be interesting to see
the raw dog that video. Huh?
Gee, this is D410 after dark, son.
Mile 34. We don't know where he got one, but he came back butt naked with a condom on his head, yelling, "Look at me, I'm a squid." And that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the What's in Your Head podcast. Thank you guys so much. And as we said before, head over to patreon.com, sign up and subscribe. You just got to be any registered account. And by the end of April, we're going to be giving away, by the way, this is a not for sale pre advance copy that the publisher sent along. And then, Morgan, Mike, and I were talking. We're going to get some prizes here to give away as well. But a lot of this stuff is just given to us by vendors, which, you know, why a lot of it seems to be World War II themes. But we're going to get some non-World War II based stuff to give away to Patreon as well. That'll be coming down in the future. But head over to YouTube.com. Look for Poles and Paddles. That is the fishing content that Mike suggested for the breakoff of Digital 410 Media. I think we're getting a lot of views. struggle is people watch shit on TV. When they watch shit on TV, they don't subscribe. So we got a hell of a lot more views than we do subscribers. But people are watching the videos. They seem to be liking it. I just got to get them to start subscribing. So head over to YouTube.com, look for Poles and Paddles, all one word, and obviously D410 Media. And also, while you're on our website at whatsinyourhead.com or d-410.com, click on those banner ads, whether you're buying dog treats, gun safes, fishing equipment, belts, gun holsters, all that stuff. Anytime you make a purchase and you click on those link, they kick us a few shekels, and all that goes into the pool to pay to keep the lights on around here, keep the bandwidth going, and the web hosting, which everybody can tell you is one of the more expensive parts of podcasting. And so thank you guys so much, and we will holler at you all next week. Yeah, Mike, I'll talk to you later tomorrow about that, how we want to do.
This has been a Digital 410 production.